You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In just the past 2 years, Will Allen has been named both a MacArthur Fellowship winner and one of the Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. And though he has been both a professional basketball player and a corporate executive, he was given those awards as a farmer. He tells his story in a new book, The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food People in Communities, which he wrote with the help of Charles Wilson. It's published by Gotham Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Will Allen to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. It's great to be here.
So there you are, 43 years old. You cashed in your retirement fund for Procter & Gamble to start a small urban farm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Was it simply a desire to return to the land?
Well, you know, I grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C. I'm the offspring of sharecroppers. Both my mother and father migrated to the D.C. area during a great African-American migration for a better life, supposedly, and unlike many African Americans at that time, they wanted to pass on our family farming legacy to myself and my brother. So I really learned a lot of the skills that I use today from my parents.
Although you say that your parents refused to talk about their past when you were growing up because sharecropping was something of an embarrassment?
Yeah, I think they really didn't talk about some of the difficulties, some of the challenges that they faced, and kind of during segregation days, Jim Crow laws and things like that. A lot of the discovery I had was through the research of and writing this book. So it was really an awakening in that respect for me.
How long did the sharecropping go on? Into the 20th century?
Yes. I mean, some sharecropping is still going on today, but in a most a little kinder way. But back then, you would work the land and have to share the crop with the landowner. And a lot of times my father at the end of the season, supposedly there was no profits, and you'd walk away with nothing. And, you know, many of the folks couldn't read or write, so they really couldn't check the books and so forth. So one day my father just dropped his plow and mule and moved to the Washington, D.C. area.
Well, you say that for your family and other black Southerners, sharecropping became slavery under another name. It was impossible to get out unless you just dropped the plow and moved somewhere else.
Yeah, and then,
if you could afford to move somewhere else.
Right, and it was a big risk because of the fears of moving into a new place, moving from the South to the North, and all of those challenges without any money, but the hope for a better life.
But after you started farming, a black friend of yours asked you why you wanted to do slave work. Was that kind of rejection of agriculture common in many families who have been part of the Great Migration?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we're seeing play out today, where those skills were not passed along to the next several generations. And when we have folks today that are living in food deserts, they really don't know how to grow food. So it, I recognized that as I started and was able to purchase the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee, and found out that many, many folks really didn't know how to grow food anymore because those skills hadn't been passed along.
And it didn't help that there were government policies that discriminated against black farmers. But I want to get to that in a little while. I want to back up a bit. You were working for Procter & Gamble, and earlier you had worked for the Marcus Corporation, where you managed several KFC branches. Now your message seems to be totally opposite to many of the goals of those companies. Was working for them a disillusioning experience?
Well, in a way, but I also, from those companies, I learned, took some of the positive things that I learned in corporate America, how to run a business and that sort of thing, and brought them. And I use some of those skills today along with, you know, my sports background of teamwork. And I kind of run Growing Power like a, kind of a sports franchise. So we kind of work together and share. Everybody's an important part of the team. No one, even myself, is more important than anybody else on the team. So it's been a pretty successful model of marrying all of those life skills that I learned along the way from my parents being the strongest influence on me in terms of growing food.
Growing Power is the organization you have created.
Yes.
Now, you actually seem to have returned to farming when you were in Belgium. Is that true? When you were playing professional basketball, you'd been a college basketball star, and then you played pro ball, but didn't make it in the NBA?
No, I got drafted by the Baltimore Bullets in the NBA and the Miami Floridians in the ABA, and I played in the American Basketball Association, and then the team went defunct. I went to Europe and played in Belgium, and actually got back into farming, because when I left the farm at 18, I said, I would never do this work again. I'm going to college, I get a college degree, I'm going to play professional basketball. Those were my, my dreams and aspirations. And once I was over in Europe, one of my European teammates, their family had a farm. I went out on the farm one day, and as soon as I touched the soil, I had this strong desire to want to farm again. I must have had some hidden passion for farming that came out. So that was a transformative moment for me.
And then you say you prepared a Thanksgiving meal in Belgium that you had totally farmed yourself.
Yeah, I got some 25 chickens, and I
They don't have turkeys in Belgium?
I grew some vegetables, and I had a friend in the Army, so we went up to the Shape Base and went to the PX, got a couple butterball turkeys, and Belgium's such a small country, so I knew all the other players, the Americans. There were two Americans on each team and in the professional league there, and I knew all of those guys, invited them to our house, my wife and myself and kids, and we had an old-fashioned Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners at our place, and used the food that I was growing along with the turkeys and hams.
Grow up on the farm?
Yeah.
Because whatever you were eating made you quite tall.
Yeah, so you still have a chance, you know.
Well, I think I'm
best.
I stopped at 6'1", which I thought was tall until I met people like you.
Yeah, I think we always ate good food. We didn't have a lot of spendable income, but one of the gifts that my parents gave us was the fact that we grew about 95% of the food that we eat. And that's something that we're trying to get people to grow more food on their balconies, like we were talking earlier, or their backyard, side yards, get rid of the grass, grow food. That's, for me, the first line of defense in terms of having a healthy body, because 2/3 of our health profile is about the nutrition, the food that we eat. And the other pieces, of course, are exercise and stress management. But if we could get that 2/3 piece fixed by eating healthy, locally grown food, getting it into our bellies the same day or the next day versus food that's shipped in from many miles away that sometimes is 10 days old before we get it into our systems.
Well, you grew your own, but you say your mother didn't like asparagus. Asparagus are hard to grow, aren't they?
Well, that was the reason my mother didn't like asparagus, because she had to pick asparagus when she was growing up. She would never fix asparagus. Now, I love asparagus, but it's something I just started eating as I became an adult.
And you figured out how to grow it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that was kind of an interesting piece that I discovered about my mother. I was wondering why we never had asparagus. You know.
Will Allen is my guest. He's written with the help of Charles Wilson, The Good Food Revolution. It has a foreword by Eric Schlosser. You probably recognize that name. He's the author of Fast Food Nation. Now, we were kind of circling around the whole matter of why there are so few black farmers today. One of the reasons, obviously, is the history. But you say also it's because black farmers are almost always small farmers. So that's public policy has worked against them?
Definitely. Our farm policies work against all small farmers, especially vegetable farmers. We of course, don't get supports like cash crop farmers. They're growing soybeans, corn, and cotton and that sort of thing. And our food policy really doesn't work. It's not a sustainable food policy to support an institution that hasn't provided us really good food, but just processed foods. And we wonder why one out of three Americans today are obese and They predict by 2030, 42% of Americans will be obese unless we change the way that we are able to grow food.
And, well, it's a particularly big problem in the African-American community.
Yeah, I think most...
Do you think because of that loss of connection to the land?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has been the loss and the fact that grocery stores have pulled out of many low-income areas, and what's left is fast food and corner stores that only have processed foods that aren't good for anybody. So we need to really resurrect. Communities have to take charge and be proactive and be responsible for growing their own food. And we have this great opportunity now, especially with the First Lady and what she did in terms of putting a garden on the White House lawn. They estimated 10 million new people started farming. And I think that has been a big help to get that kind of support.
Well, the USDA has changed its policies as far as giving loans to farmers also, at least black farmers. Didn't it discriminate for years?
Yeah, there was some discrimination in terms of Farm Service Agency. There's a lawsuit that's still going on to compensate African-American farmers. At one point, there were 300,000 African-American farmers in the country in the 20s and 30s, and now we're down to 18,000. So there's been a tremendous drop in farmers. Less than 1% of farmers are now African-American. And the policies in the South, of course, have created a situation where most of the farming in the South is pretty much industrialized agriculture.
You were denied disaster insurance money after a flood destroyed your crop one year. Do you think it was racially based, that decision?
I believe it was, because it was so obvious that I had 5 feet of water over my entire farm. And I had pitchers, I had the whole, you know, everything that they asked for to get some disaster relief, and I was denied.
And you were hinting at something that's one of your messages here, that there are two very different food systems in this country, one for the rich and one for the poor. Is money the main factor? Isn't also access to nutritional food an issue?
Well, it's access, but it's also money, because most of the really good food that you find in high-end stores are not in these communities. Like I said before, these are food desert communities with not even any regular conventional retail grocery stores. So that access is a huge piece of it, and education is another piece in terms of educating folks to eat healthier. But I think the tide has definitely turned, and that's the reason we call this book The Good Food Revolution, because, like I said, many people, thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, want to eat better now, but we have to build the infrastructure, the local food infrastructure, to be able to do that.
Well, during World War II, people were encouraged to have victory gardens, and you would have thought that would have affected the culture, but right after the war, we actually moved in the opposite direction. And there is still a lot of, I don't know what word to use, hostility to people growing their own food. My own landlady doesn't want me to compost. She doesn't want me to grow vegetables on my outdoor space, because she says the soil is too heavy.
Right. Well, part of the problem was, you know, back in the early 60s, you know, the Ag Department said told all of us farmers to grow soybeans and corn fence row to fence row, and we're going to feed the world. Well, we see what that has led to. There's more hunger in the world than ever before. Tonight, one out of every six children will go to bed without a meal. So in America, and we should be ashamed of that. It's really about the work that we're doing is really about social and food justice. That's what it's about, because everybody should have the right to eat healthy, safe, affordable food, the same food. We shouldn't have different categories of food for different folks based on their economics.
Now, what you've done with Growing Power is a lot more than just simply try to spread the word. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to talk about what you've done in this plot of land in Milwaukee and why you didn't just stay on the farm that you were given originally. My guest is Will Allen, who has written, with the help of Charles Wilson, The Good Food Revolution. It is published by Gotham Books. Stay with us. We're back with Will Allen, who, after retiring from professional basketball and executive positions at KFC and Procter & Gamble, became CEO of Growing Power, and now he has written a book about his experiences called The Good Food Revolution. Alice Waters says, Will Allen's remarkable story, told with an eloquence and compassion, conveys the universal value of social justice and real food. He's written it with the help of Charles Wilson, and there's a foreword by Eric Schlosser. So, okay, so you were a professional basketball player. You retired. You went to work for Procter & Gamble and the company that has KFC outlets. And then you decided to become a farmer, and you had a little plot of land in the country. You moved there. What led you to think about becoming an urban farmer in the middle of Milwaukee, of all places?
Well, I was growing. I got up to about 100 acres of vegetables I was growing, and I was pretty much wholesaling those to grocery stores back in the late 70s, early 80s. And all of a sudden, many of those grocery stores started buying from headquarters and knocked a lot of us farmers out from delivering to individual grocery stores. So I decided what we need to do is sell more direct to communities. And being right outside of Milwaukee, about 30 minutes outside of the city on my 100-acre farm, I decided to start a small farm co-op with four other individuals. And we started bringing food by the truckload into wholesalers. And I also
are there farmers markets in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I helped establish like 13 farmers markets in Milwaukee, and one large farmers market that I was the president of. The farmers ran it and was very successful for many, many years. But I also wanted a retail space. And I was still working for Procter & Gamble as I was putting my kids through high school and college. And I was driving down the street one day, and I saw this for sale sign for this old greenhouse operation and farm. It was 3 acres, and I took down the number and called and found out the city owned the property. And so we were going through a transition at Procter & Gamble and restructures and so forth. So it was a good time for me to leave, and I really wanted to farm full-time, and I would have to put my full effort into resurrecting this old greenhouse nursery operation. So I was able to make the purchase from the city of Milwaukee. I found a bank that would lend me the money, and I cashed in my retirement and took a big gamble, and everybody thought I was crazy and a fool for doing it. But
what condition was this plot of land in?
Well, the greenhouses, there were six A-frame greenhouses. The glass was, some glass was missing. Kids had thrown rocks through the windows. The previous owner wasn't very friendly to the neighbors, and the kids, of course, took it out on him. And as he was struggling, trying to make a living, and had lost the place to the city for taxes. And so it was a real fixer-upper, and it pretty much took a huge gamble.
And you decided to start growing right away and leave the fixing until later because you had to start generating some income?
Yeah, I had to start generating income. So I was bringing food. This is located on the northwest side of Milwaukee, halfway between two freeways, one that goes to Green Bay, Wisconsin, and one goes to Fond du Lac. And it was halfway between the largest housing project was five blocks away, a 75-acre facility. Heavy population, very densely populated area. Closest retail grocery store over 3.5 miles away, so it was either direction. So it was definitely a food desert. In the harsh Wisconsin winters, you know, people are pretty hunkered down in their homes, and the only access to food really was fast food and corner stores with, processed food. So people were really suffering, and I thought this would be an opportunity to bring in some really healthy food and to engage some of the youth in the community to work in my facility.
Well, the soil in cities is usually not all that conducive to farming. There's usually a lot of lead and all that. Do you have to bring in your own soil?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I've always done, and if you talk to any farmer, they'll tell you it's all about the soil. So if you remember anything that I say when it comes to growing food, especially intensively and with high nutrients in the food, it's really all about the soil, what's in the soil. So I had learned how to compost at an early age and started composting on the site and really scaled it up to where we are today with our 20 farms that we now operate and 110 employees. But we compost 40 million pounds of food and carbon residue into thousands of pounds of compost to be able to do what we do.
So rather than put it in the city dump, you're actually creating soil. And you've become a strong advocate for worms. I remember the first time I talked to you, convinced me that if I was going to compost, I had to get worms.
Well,
now I have a lot of worms because worms create more worms. They really do reproduce pretty quickly.
Yeah, they reproduce at four times their number every 4 months. And, of course, if you have 30 worms in every square foot of soil, you wouldn't have to do anything to the soil. But if you dig in your backyard, I don't think anybody will find 30 worms in every square foot of soil. So what we have to do, we grow soil, and at the end of the process, we inject worms. We started out with 30 pounds of worms 15 years ago, and now we have 7,000 pounds of worms on the one farm.
So you opened up a farm stand.
Yes.
And you described that as rather exciting, but you also write that many of your black customers preferred white vendors who had the same or worse produce than you at the farmer's market. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think at the time when I first started going to the farmer's market, I would have better-looking stuff, and I was right next door to farmers who had the same product, and they would pass me by and go over to the white farmer and buy, because I think, there's this dynamic about maybe your stuff isn't as good or something, you know.
Reverse racism.
Yeah. But that changed as time went by to the point that when I first tried to get into that farmer's market, I was denied a spot there, and I wound up being the president of the farmer's market. When the city dropped the budget, everybody came to me because it was anchored in an African-American community, and they wanted me to talk to the community members and see if we could save the farmer's market. And I formed a co-op, and we were able to do that. And
you had to fight after you were denied a spot, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it was I eventually got one on the exterior of the market, and because of the crops that I grew, I drew large crowds, and of course I got dirty looks from the other farmers, and I eventually got a spot in the market. So.
But then you decided to expand beyond just growing stuff and selling at farmers markets or at a roadside stand. When did you start inviting kids to come and learn at your farm?
Well, we started that at the very beginning. That was one of the declarations I made with the city when I was able to purchase this farm, because it was between me and a church for the property. And I got lucky because the alderperson, Don Richards, who is now on our board, retired alderperson, really liked my proposal. Because I said I was going to grow food, resurrect these old greenhouses in his automatic district, and hire youth from the community. And Don, who grew up on a farm in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, was an ex-priest, stated at the meeting that he had enough churches in his district, and what I was going to be doing is religion in itself if I do everything I said I'm going to do.
You write that when you first handed the group of kids seedlings, they didn't know which end went up and which went into the ground. Has anything else happened that has surprised you like that?
Well, that was many of the kids didn't know the difference between a cucumber and a zucchini or what a pepper. Most kids, when they do surveys around the country, even in the South, think their food comes from grocery stores or whatever. So, because again, like I said before, a lot of the skills were not passed down for several generations. So now we're having to educate all of these young kids about where their food comes from, how it's grown, what it's grown in soil. So taking them through the whole process was something that was really effective early on in those years.
And have you followed up with them? Have many of these kids started farming themselves?
Well, we have many of the kids that were in our program. Some of them started when they were 15 years old, 12, 13, 14, 15, or over 30 years old. And many of them we helped get into colleges around the country, and they've come back and they work for our organization. Like I said, we have 110 employees, and many of these young people have come back to the community, and they're working for Growing Power.
You also educate adults, and you even went on a freedom ride through the South to teach people in the South how to people who come out of farming families but have lost that contact, how to return to it?
Well, a lot of the, like I said before, a lot of the families, the older grandmothers, grandfathers had died off, and because of the harsh reality of growing food in the South and under those stressful conditions, you know, these families didn't want to pass on the legacy of farming to the next generation. So now more people in the South want to start growing their food because on family land that had been rented out and so forth. So we have several regional training centers in the South, in Mississippi and Arkansas and Louisville, Kentucky, and Georgia, and Atlanta, Georgia. We have 15 regional training centers around the U.S. where we're working with organizations in those areas to revamp the food system.
And that all began with a greenhouse with broken panes of glass.
Yeah, it's
extraordinary.
Been,
And more. Just first, let me tell my audience that my guest is Will Allen, CEO of Growing Power. He's written a book called The Good Food Revolution with the help of Charles Wilson. It has a foreword by Eric Schlosser. You have an apiary, and you farm fish now, and you've also gotten involved with helping people get their own meat.
Yeah, we have a pretty integrated food system. We grow over 150 different varieties of vegetables, fruit, and edible flowers, And we also have been doing aquaculture, raising tilapia and yellow perch. And we work with the Great Lakes Institute at the University, UW-Milwaukee, to really quantify a lot of things and to research how to grow lake perch that are mercury contaminated in Lake Michigan. And there's a moratorium on commercial fishing for that, the favorite fish in Wisconsin. So we're raising about 100,000 fish at our facility, our main facility, and we're training people all over the world how to raise fish in these low-cost recirculating fish systems that we construct.
And you partnered with Heifer International, an organization that provides livestock to poor families abroad. They wanted to bring the program to your area, but livestock regulations it made that difficult. You can't bring livestock into Milwaukee or other cities of that size?
Well, at that time, you couldn't. You couldn't bring chickens or have bees and that sort of thing.
You can have chickens in New York now, you know, and bees?
Yeah, we can now in Milwaukee as well, in all three.
But no roosters here?
No roosters, for obvious reasons. But, yeah, Heifer International was instrumental, especially a young lady named Allison Mears Cohen, who works for Why Hunger Year, she brought bees and the fish in small systems as a youth project that I took and developed systems that are commercial-sized systems now. We raise fish in 10,000-gallon systems. We started out with these 55-gallon systems, and now we're training people all over the world how to do this using renewable energy. We use a lot of renewable energy to cut the cost of production.
Because you say that a chicken produces about 10 watts of energy.
Yeah, I think it's about 5 therms per chicken. So they generate a lot of heat. So one of the things that we did early on is had greenhouses where we would put chicken wire and separate the chickens from the crops and be able to grow food year-round, because we do grow food year-round in our hoop houses and greenhouses, in Milwaukee. And one of the things that we wanted to quantify is that you can do that year-round. And if you can do it in Milwaukee, you can surely do it in almost any state in the nation.
So you've created a kind of mini ecosystem inside your greenhouse?
Yeah, you can pretty much grow anything in those greenhouses. And the fact that we grow our own soil, which also helps cut the production costs, because our food prices are really predicated, or they should be, on the cost of production. And, of course, when you think of organic food today, I think a lot of organic food is artificially inflated because of the word organic. Doesn't make it maybe as good as the food that we grow, and many farmer friends of mine call the food that they grow beyond organic, you know.
Well, you also, by doing that, you cut your energy bill, which, of course, made everything efficient and allowed you to charge less money. Have you noticed changes in the neighborhood since you started?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen the health of the neighborhood change. We've seen the whole dynamics in terms of who's moving into the neighborhood. That 75-acre housing project is now being reconstructed, and we're involved with the Housing Authority to put a three-quarter of an acre garden in the center of this new housing development. It'll be mixed-income community. It won't be just a low-income community anymore. So there have been tremendous changes in our neighborhood around our National Training Center.
And it seems like you thrive on small victories, like when certain locals fought the opening of a new fried chicken restaurant in the neighborhood. I don't know whether it was a KFC outlet or whether your old bosses got annoyed with you. Then there was the kid who stole a goat on a dare, and he brought it back to you.
Yeah, I mean, because we got engaged with the community, especially the young people, that led to bringing their parents, the adults, into our facility, and we let folks use our facility for meetings and that sort of thing. So we're really looked at as an asset to the community, and it's really solved a lot of the social ills that you find in other communities and bringing the community together.
One of our listeners asked on our show page if visitors are able to view your gardens and greenhouses.
Yeah, we have, last year we have over 20,000 visitors that come to Growing Power, and each year in Milwaukee, we host a national, international conference, and we have a conference on growing food injustice, really dismantling racism around the food system, with over 1,000 people and organizations from around the country that come. And we host that within our organization because one of the things that everything that we do is about social and food justice. We're wrapped around all of the activities, which are over 70 different things that we do around the food system now.
Now, you know that we're fundraising here at WNYC. Would all of this be possible if you didn't do a lot of fundraising for yourself? You must rely on grant money for a lot of the startups.
Well, our largest income source is our own efforts to sell products and services, because early on, when we became a nonprofit, we started the first couple of years, we were a for-profit, and then my friends talked me into starting this nonprofit. Nobody would give us any money. I don't come from the nonprofit arena, so I said, well, since nobody will give us grants, let's go out and make some money. Mm-hmm. So over 50% of our income today comes from our own efforts of selling products and services. We have over 40 income streams that come into Growing Power. We do write grants. We have a very small development staff, but we're able to get grants today because I guess we've proved ourselves over all of these 18, 19 years we've been doing this work.
You provide advice in the book, from how to make your own compost to how to get by with limited resources. What do you hope readers will take away from it?
Well, I think when Charles and I got together on this project, one of the things that I really wanted to do is show the historical legacy of especially African Americans as they moved through slavery, through Reconstruction, to the Great Migration, Jim Crow laws. So it's a lot of history that I think high school students and college students can learn from this book. along with some personal stories about my life and my family's legacy in farming that probably mirrors many other African-American families in the country. I think it'll be a book that anybody can read and get some lessons from.
Inspire a lot of people to do a little bit of farming on their own.
Right, because one of the projects that we launched this year was 20,000 Backyard Gardens. We plan to help 20,000 people in Metro Milwaukee grow gardens by providing compost and getting them, because that's the first line of our really good help.
Will Allen will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 6 o'clock at the Brooklyn Rescue Mission. That's at 255 Bainbridge Street in Brooklyn. His book, The Good Food Revolution, written with the help of Charles Wilson, is published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Leonard, and I hope you keep growing food on your back porch.
I'm not giving up now. It tastes better.
Okay, I'll be checking on you.